Good afternoon, and welcome to today's The Best of NERA 2009 broadcast by the Securities and Exchange Commission Historical Society on www.sechistorical.org. I am Lisa Fairfax, the Leroy Sorensen Merrifield Research Professor of Law at the George Washington University Law School and moderator of what I think will be a very stimulating program today. The SEC Historical Society preserves and shares the history of financial regulation through its virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org. The museum is free and accessible worldwide at all times. The museum, as well as the society, are separate and independent of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission and receive no government funding. Thus, we thank the gifts and grants from many institutions and individuals who make possible the growth and outreach of the virtual museum and archive to over 9,000 visitors each month. Since 2004, in partnership with NERA Economic Consulting, the museum has broadcast the annual The Best of NERA program, highlighting top presentations from NERA Economic Consulting's recent finance, law, and securities litigation seminar. The Society is grateful for the continuing generous sponsorship of NERA Economic Consulting for this series. Past broadcasts from the series can be accessed at any time in both podcast and edited transcript formats in the Best of NERA section of programs at www.sechistorical.org. I am delighted to welcome our guests today, and I will introduce them in their speaking order. First, Jan Larson, consultant, NERA Economic Consulting, who will discuss recent trends in SEC settlements and policy changes with implications for future enforcement actions. Followed by Dr. Marcia Kramer Mayer, Senior Vice President, with her proposal for regulatory and legislative changes to help the SEC detect Ponzi schemes quickly and cost-effectively. Then Dr. Robert Mackey, Senior Vice President, who will share his insights in recent proposals to regulate credit default swaps and other over-the-counter derivatives. And finally, Dr. Thomas Porter, Senior Vice President, who will discuss the guidance in FAS 157, Fair Market Values. And with that, I will turn the program over to Jan Larson.
Thanks, Lisa, and thanks to everyone at the SEC Historical Society for having us here today. I think we can all agree that this has been a dynamic year for the Securities and Exchange Commission. The SEC has a new chair, Mary Shapiro, and a new director of enforcement, Robert Kuzami. As a result of the Madoff scandal and financial crisis, calls for reform have come from outside and inside the agency, with certain reforms already in place. Today I'm going to talk about the implications of this shifting landscape for the SEC's enforcement activities, as well as recent trends in SEC settlements. I'm going to begin by walking you through the steps that lead from an investigation to an enforcement action and settlement, highlighting recently proposed and recently implemented reforms of the process along the way. SEC investigations can be triggered in many ways, including the review of forms filed with the SEC, routine inspections of persons or entities regulated by the SEC, news reports, referrals from other government agencies, referrals from stock exchanges, information received in other SEC investigations, and tips from whistleblowers. On the latter point, the SEC is planning to request new legislation that would allow it to offer incentives for whistleblowers to come forward in any type of securities fraud case. These incentives could include cash or immunity deals. This would represent a major expansion of the SEC's authority to offer incentives to whistleblowers, which is currently limited to insider trading cases. The first stage of an SEC action is typically something called an informal investigation, also known as an inquiry. At this stage, the Commission staff has no subpoena power and must rely on the cooperation of the relevant individuals and entities to gather information. At the conclusion of an informal investigation, SEC staff may recommend that the Commission undertake an enforcement action seeking sanctions if they think that the evidence clearly shows that a securities law violation has occurred. Or they may conclude the investigation without recommending an enforcement action if they believe that it is unlikely that a violation has occurred. Or they may seek a formal order of investigation from the Commission if they believe more evidence is needed. When the SEC staff request and receive a formal order, a formal investigation begins, which differs from an informal investigation in that the SEC staff can compel the production of evidence and testimony rather than relying on the cooperation of the relevant individuals and entities. For a formal order to be approved, the SEC staff must establish that, based on the available evidence, it is likely that a securities law violation has occurred. This is one of the areas where there has already been a reform under Mary Shapiro. Previously, formal orders could only be approved at full meetings of all five commissioners, which could sometimes take weeks to schedule. There was concern within the agency that these scheduling issues could compromise time-sensitive investigations. Because of these concerns, early this year, Ms. Shapiro revised the process for obtaining formal orders so that now they can be approved by just one commissioner. The next step after a formal investigation is typically the Wells process. If the staff has determined to recommend that the commission commence an enforcement action, it typically gives prospective defendants a Wells notice informing them of the staff's intent. The recipient of a Wells notice has the opportunity to provide a Wells submission, which is essentially a brief arguing that an enforcement action is not merited. Upon reviewing the Wells submission, the staff may elect to modify or reverse its recommendation to the commission. The commission itself also reviews the Wells submission before determining whether to follow the staff's proposed course of action. Up to this point, I have described typical precursors to an SEC enforcement action. However, when the SEC staff believes that it is dealing with a highly time-sensitive matter with clear evidence of a securities law violation, it may skip any or all of the steps that I've described so far and instead recommend that the commission undertake an enforcement action straight away. Upon the staff's recommendation to bring an enforcement action, the commission has several options. It may authorize a civil action in federal court, an administrative proceeding before an administrative law judge, or no enforcement proceeding at all. Whether the commission authorizes a civil action in federal court or an administrative proceeding depends on several factors, including the severity of the allegations, the nature of the conduct alleged, tactical considerations, and the type of sanctions sought. For instance, the failure of SEC-regulated entities to properly supervise their employees may only be addressed through an administrative proceeding. While monetary penalties against persons and entities not directly regulated by the SEC may only be sought in federal court. As an example of tactical concerns, the SEC may only subpoena individuals to appear in federal court if they reside within 100 miles of the courthouse, whereas in administrative proceedings, the commission has nationwide subpoena power. When the circumstances warrant it, the commission may bring both types of action. The SEC has recently proposed new legislation that would neutralize some of the considerations that go into the decision of what type of action to bring. The agency plans to request nationwide subpoena power in federal court, as well as penalty authority against all respondents in administrative cease and desist proceedings, whether they are regulated or not. After an enforcement action has been commenced, the next step is resolution. The majority of SEC enforcement actions are resolved through settlement rather than litigation, and indeed the process of negotiating a settlement is another area where there has been an important reform under Ms. Shapiro. At the beginning of 2007, former SEC Chair Christopher Cox instituted what has been called the Penalty Pilot Program. Under this program, SEC staff were required to obtain pre-approved penalty ranges before beginning settlement negotiations with publicly traded companies. Ms. Shapiro brought the penalty pilot program to an end shortly after taking over as chair, citing concerns that the program introduced delays in corporate penalty cases, discouraged SEC staff from seeking penalties in certain cases where they may have been warranted, and sometimes resulted in reductions in the size of penalties. The agency is also seeking additional legislative changes that could impact its future enforcement activities. For example, the SEC is seeking penalty authority against aiders and abettors under the Investment Advisors Act. The Treasury Department's recent report, Financial Regulatory Reform, A New Foundation, advocates several SEC reforms, including requiring advisors of private funds, such as hedge funds or private equity funds, to register with the SEC, more stringent SEC oversight of credit rating agencies, and legislation that would enable the SEC to require that the compensation committees of public companies be more independent. Given all that's been going on behind the scenes, let's take a quick look at recent SEC settlement activity. Through the first half of 2009, the SEC settled with 335 defendants, very much in line with the 330 defendants the agency settled with through the first half of 2008. The largest settlement so far this year were the $200 million settlement with UBS for allegedly facilitating tax evasion, and the $177 million settlement with Halliburton and KBR for alleged violations of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. All other settlements in the first half of the year were for less than $100 million. Now let's dig a little deeper into what the dollars have been looking like in SEC settlements. I'm going to talk a little about average and median settlement values, but when I do that, I'm going to exclude $0 settlements from my calculations. One reason for this is that there are certain SEC cases where the agency either cannot or simply chooses not to seek monetary payments. Including these cases would therefore artificially reduce the average and median settlement values. For reference, in the first half of 2009, 64% of settlements with companies and 58% of settlements with individuals included monetary payments. Among company defendants whose settlements included monetary payments, the average settlement amount in the first half of 2009 was $10.1 million, an increase from the average of $8.4 million in 2008. The median company settlement, which is the settlement with an equal number of values above and below it, was $1.6 million in the first half of the year, an increase from the 2008 median of $1.3 million. If the 2009 median remains at $1.6 million, it'll be the largest median value in any year since the passage of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. For individual defendants, the numbers have been much lower and flatter. The average individual settlement amount was $1.1 million, equal to the 2008 average. The median individual settlement was $100,000, as it has been in every year since 2003. I've reached the end of my time, but if you'd like further information on recent trends in SEC settlements, there's a lot more information on our dedicated website, securitieslitigationtrends.com. Thanks for your time. I'm turning the mic back over to Lisa now.
Thank you. And next we'll hear from Marcia.
Thank you, Lisa, and the SEC Historical Society. How does $65 billion in assets purportedly under management come to see? That's the combined asset value that Bernard Madoff Investment Securities reported to clients on their November 2008 statements. Virtually none was real, as the world learned days later when the biggest ever Ponzi scheme came to light. The SEC has taken deserved heat for failing to detect Madoff's massive and long-running scam. The official report has yet to be issued on how the watchdog agency allowed itself to be fooled by Madoff's machinations, despite the many red flags that whistleblower Harry Markopoulos brought to its attention. Whether the explanation proves to be insufficient resources, inadequate systems, insufficiently savvy staff, misplaced priorities, or willful blindness, we need a better way. Today, I'll review aspects of the current regulatory regime and the anti-fraud proposals now on the table, and then outline my own proposal for better equipping the SEC to detect Ponzi schemes. The current regulatory regime falls short on three counts. For starters, most investment advisors aren't required to register with the SEC. A few are exempt because they manage less than $25 million, but others because they have fewer than 15 clients, as each hedge fund advisee counts as just a single client for registration purposes. The registration shortfall is problem number one. Second, SEC registration, as presently constituted, is not a game-ender for Ponzi operators. Madoff was a registered investment advisor, but he flat-out lied on his disclosure forms. On his last ADV, for example, filed in 2008, Madoff reported $17 billion in assets under management, a far cry from the $65 billion he was telling investors and the negligible sum he actually held on their behalf. Even further from the truth was his reported client count, 23, as compared to the almost 5,000 active accounts that the SIPC trustee found as of the firm's demise. Despite the enormity of these misrepresentations, no alarm sounded within the SEC. Perhaps the greater wonder is why none went off at the Palm Beach Country Club. That the SEC has no ready way to validate the representations of registered investment advisors, or even to know when they're telling one thing to customers and something else to the commission, is problem number two. A third problem with the current system is that there's no requirement for investment advisors to use an independent custodian. The Madoff firm truthfully disclosed that it did not use one. By permitting advisors to provide self-custody, current regulations facilitate misrepresentations about assets under management. So what's in the works? Two measures of note. The administration's regulatory reform bill would require advisors of hedge funds to register with the SEC if they managed at least $30 million in assets. Under a pending SEC proposal, the commission would effectively mandate a qualified independent custodian. Both measures improve on the status quo from the standpoint of Ponzi scheme prevention and detection, but they don't go far enough. With respect to the custody regs, one concern is that a supposedly independent custodian might be complicit with a scheming advisor. Another worry is that a Ponzi artist might direct some incoming customer assets in such a way that its custodian never learned of them. As for the administration bill, investment advisors to funds are covered, but those with discretion over non-pooled monies aren't. Notably, Madoff did not operate a hedge fund, but rather he purported to invest on behalf of clients individually. Another weakness in the administration bill is that it gives the SEC no ready means to test the veracity of registrants' disclosures. If the custodian were deceived or complicit, the task of asset validation would fall to the SEC. The law should better equip it to this role. Rather than accept at face value the income components, the tax, if Congress and the SEC are serious about protecting investors from Ponzi schemes, they need look no further than the IRS for an approach that is both simple and well-tested. Multiple source reporting of entity-specific data. Rather than accept at face value the income components that taxpayers report on their 1040s, the IRS comprehensively cross-checks those claims against W-2s, 1099s, and K-1s submitted by employers, financial institutions, and other income payers. When discrepancies are identified, the IRS attempts to reconcile the numbers. The institutionalization of cross-checking improves the accuracy of the final numbers, not only by correcting errors, but by motivating honest reporting in the first instance. The SEC must be similarly empowered to routinely and cost-effectively validate the data that it needs to effectively police investment advisors. Instead of it having to rely on the most self-interested party, the advisor, for routine information on assets under management, I propose a system under which multiple organizations would be required and individual investors encouraged to provide the commission with data about each assets, about each advisor's managed assets. Investment advisors with at least $30 million under management would be required to report quarter-end assets by account, identified by name, tax ID, and account number. Independent custodians would be required to report to the commission quarter-end assets under management for each advisor client by position, indicating both size and market value. To give teeth to this mandate, advisors would be required to use an independent custodian. And finally, investors would be invited, though not required, to report to the SEC on a new standalone schedule their quarter-end assets under management by advisor and account. The data would feed into computers to make comparisons efficiently and comprehensively. One would be of total assets under management, measured using advisor data, the sum of the asset values reported for each account, and custodian data, the sum of the asset values reported for each position. The other set of comparisons would involve account-level assets under management, obtained from the advisor for all accounts and from participating investors for their own. For any given date and account, these values should agree. If there were large, numerous, or recurrent discrepancies for an advisor, a well-focused SEC inquiry would ensue to determine whether any claimed assets were unaccounted for. The involvement of individual investors is the linchpin of this plan. Even with a truly independent custodian, an advisor could run a Ponzi scheme by having some investment funds deposited into an account that the custodian was unaware of while the firm ran a legitimate operation with assets the custodian saw. An advisor engaged in such asset diversion would report to the SEC only those assets under management that its custodian was privy to. If the SEC had no ready means of learning that the advisor was reporting a lot more to its investors, the scheme might go undetected. That is where investor reporting comes in. When an asset diverting advisor could not protect itself, what an asset diverting advisor could not protect itself from under my plan is a random investor reporting her account's asset value to the SEC. Unless the advisor informed the SEC of all account level assets, any one investor report could trip it up. In the end, Ponzi scheme prevention and detection requires keeping an eye on customer assets. If investor self-interest can be harnessed to motivate at least some advisory clients to report their assets under management, and advisors can be made to fund the system, the SEC can tackle the Ponzi problem quickly, effectively, and at minimal cost to taxpayers.
Thank you very much, Marcia. And now, Robert.
Thank you, Lisa. What I want to talk about today is credit default swaps. Given the attention that credit default swap contracts have received in the last year as the credit crisis has unfolded, I think it's important to address this particular financial contract. And I really have four goals in my talk today. The first is to help demystify credit default swaps. Secondly, I'd like to put credit default swaps in their broader family context with other more traditional credit risk transfer products. I'd like to briefly explain how credit default swaps are used to manage risk and to take positions. And finally, I'd like to briefly examine how the credit risk of the counterparties of credit default swaps is managed. So in short, I want to quickly address sort of what are credit default swap contracts and how are they used. Well, for a quick definition, a credit default swap contract is simply a financial contract in which one party, the protection buyer, pays a periodic fee, which is known as the credit default spread, to another party known as the protection seller in return for compensation in the event of default or some similar credit event by a third party that's known as the reference entity. The protection buyer is said to be long the credit default swap, the protection seller, or the provider is said to be short the credit default swap. And CDS contracts, as are known, can be either physically settled, where the long delivers the bond in exchange for par in the event of default, or cash settled, where the long pays the short the difference between the par value of the bond and the current value of the bond. Let me just quickly turn to sort of how a credit default swap is used to transfer credit risk, because in my view, credit default swaps are in some sense sort of the ultimate credit risk transfer product. They're one of the key financial building blocks in our financial system. If we think about a corporate borrower who's issued debt, looks at General Motors, for example, they've issued a bond. Investors have bought that bond. They expect to receive interest and principal. They may become concerned about the default risk of General Motors, as some did over the last year. And if they wish to buy protection against that event, they might go to a bank and purchase a credit default swap, paying a spread for that protection. So now, now they actually are, as we say, long the bond and long the credit default swap, and they've eliminated the credit risk of General Motors default. As we'll see, of course, they have to also worry about the credit risk of the writer of the credit default swap. Well, it's important to realize that while credit default swaps are sort of the, in some sense, represent the evolution of credit risk transfer products, there's a long family tree here that goes before the evolution of credit default swaps. There's a lot of cousins and aunts and uncles and grandparents out there before we get to CDSs. Before credit default swaps, there were parent guarantees. A subsidiary, an unrated subsidiary of a corporation may want to raise money. Given the fact that it's unrated and not a very good credit risk, it would have to do so at a high rate. Might turn to its parent and ask the parent to guarantee its obligations. And then it's able to borrow at a rate that reflects the parent's credit rating as opposed to its credit rating. That's actually a structure that's quite similar to the credit default swap. There's also surety bonds or bond wraps. A municipality, for example, may issue a municipal bond. Given the credit rating of the municipality, it might face a higher interest rate than it would like. It could turn to an insurance company such as FGIC and purchase a bond wrap that would pay off in the event the city failed to meet its obligations. In that case, the issuer of the bond actually pays for the protection as opposed to the purchaser of the bonds. Finally, there's just traditional, very long-time banking product, letters of credit. A borrower of funds, in order to give the lender of funds some assurance of repayment, may turn to a bank and pay a fee in order to provide a letter of credit that will meet the obligations in the event that they fail to do so. And we could go on. There's trade credit insurance and other types of arrangements, either banking products or insurance products, that perform very much the same function that the credit default swaps perform. In some cases, different parties pay for the protection, but it comes down to basically performing the same economic function. Let me take a moment to talk about how credit default swaps are used. And let me go back to sort of the first example we had. We had an investor that was long a bond on General Motors and then bought a credit default swap on General Motors. Effectively, those two positions, long the risky bond, long the credit default swaps, is equivalent to being long a default-free bond. And I'm assuming for now that the writer of the credit default swap doesn't have any default risk. That's a classic example in which the credit default swap is simply being used to hedge the credit risk of that risky bonds. Or some people also think of it as a way of replicating default-free deposits. In some cases, you may actually go out and buy the bond and buy the credit default swap together, and you create, because of mispricings in the market, you create a risk-free deposit that yields a higher rate of return than you may be able to get otherwise. Those are two classic uses of credit default swaps. Secondly, you may use a credit default swap to replicate a risky bond position. That is, you may go out and sell the credit default swap and simultaneously put your money, say, suppose you had $100 million worth of the bond, you might put that $100 million in treasuries. So now you're long a default-free bond, you're short the CDS, you basically have replicated the risky bond position. You may be able to do that and do it at a higher yield than you could do otherwise. Finally, two other quick examples. If you go short the CDS contract, well, that's economically equivalent to being long the risky bond and short the default-free bond in terms of the financial arithmetic we've been going through here. It's another way of thinking of the short CDS position is basically replicating a financed position in that risky bond. And finally, if you just go out and buy the CDS itself, you're essentially long a default-free bond and you're short the risky bond. So essentially what you've done is you've replicated the short risky bond position. That's another way in which you can short that bond if you have a particular perspective on the outlook on the fortunes of the company. Each of those economic relationships describes a particular way in which credit default swaps are used to either manage and hedge risk or to take advantage of mispricings in the market or to actually take on positions that reflect your view of the likely credit changes in credit risk of that company. In each of these cases, the credit risk of that guarantee, we talk about managing credit risk, but we now have to recognize, as we learned so through such painful lessons in 2008, we have to worry about the credit risk of the credit protection provider. If the corporate parent gets into financial distress, your parent guarantee is not worth much. If the monoline insurer gets into financial distress, as happened to a couple of the major monolines last year, the value of the bond wrap may not be worth much. When banks, commercial banks or investment banks, get into financial distress, the letters of credit or the CDS contracts they've written can lose their value. So it's important in looking at these credit default swaps to actually consider not just the credit that they're directly meant to manage, but also the credit of the underlying, the writer of the credit default swaps. We saw the credit default swap spreads, for example, on monoline insurers rise from under 50 basis points in early 07 to almost 1,500 or in mid-08 and after downgrades up to 3,000 basis points. We saw similar increases, although not of that magnitude, of increases of that type, in the credit default swap spreads for Citi and for Goldman Sachs in the aftermath of the Lehman bankruptcies, rising from in the 50 basis point range in late 07 into the 300 to 500 basis point range in the fall of 08. So there's credit risk in the credit default swaps, and then that just raises the question, well, how is that credit risk managed? Well, if we back up and we just remember that credit default swaps are basically over-the-counter derivatives contracts, they're bilateral then in nature. You have a bilateral credit exposure that has to be managed, and that credit exposure is managed as it is for other derivatives under the ISDA Master Agreement and the credit support annexes, typically by posting collateral and through payment netting and through marking to market of those positions. Let me close with that, and I think we'll come back and maybe talk about some of the regulatory issues at the end here.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. And now, Tom.
Thank you, Lisa, and thank you to the SEC Historical Society for having Neera down here today. I'm going to talk about an area of, I'm sure everyone's interested in, which is an accounting area. And in particular, I'd like to discuss the facts and fictions of fair value. In the recent credit crisis, accounting standards have received a substantial amount of undue blame as being the cause of that credit crisis. The allegation has been that mark-to-market rules caused financial institutions to reflect unrealistically low values for their portfolios, which triggered a variety of dilemmas related to capital requirements and liquidity. A particular publication by the FASB, the Financial Accounting Standards Board, that sets generally accepted accounting principles, FAS 157, fair value measurements, has been a favorite target. I would like to take the opportunity I have today to describe some differences between the notions of mark-to-market accounting and the concept of fair value that's embodied in FAS 157. I'm sure that we're all familiar with mark-to-market accounting. In using mark-to-market accounting, we usually assign a value to a security that is based on a current market price, and the latest trade of that security is often viewed as the market value. I think we all do this at the end of the year when we look at our portfolios, if we have any portfolios left, where we look at the prices of the closing prices in the Wall Street Journal to figure out our net worth positions. That's mark-to-market accounting because you're using the last market price to determine the value of your holdings. However, in financial accounting standards, there's a requirement that financial instruments be reflected at fair value. And we usually, in the past, and it's worked well, measured fair value using mark-to-market accounting. In other words, the latest trade price was regarded as the evidence of fair value. Well, in 2006, the Financial Accounting Standards Board issued a FAS 157 with some clear objectives in mind. First was to provide a single definition of the concept of fair value, because fair value is required across a number of accounting standards. The second was to establish a framework for measuring fair value. And the third was to provide some expanded disclosures about fair value measurements contained in financial statements. Interestingly, the third sentence of FAS 157 states that this statement does not require any new fair value measurements. So despite the fact that FAS 157 has been a target for causing the credit crisis because of its mark-to-market requirements, it's pretty clear that it didn't cause any new mark-to-market requirements. It just changed the way we do those. We determine the fair value. So the FAS 157 definition of fair value is the following. It's the price that would be received to sell an asset or pay to transfer a liability in an orderly transaction between market participants. In other words, the accounting definition of the fair value of an asset is the price that would be received in a hypothetical transaction that is orderly, that's not a forced transaction or subject to any market imperfections. The way that an entity would go about measuring and disclosing the fair value of an asset or liability would be to use what's called the fair value hierarchy. And the fair value hierarchy refers to the relationship between the information used to price an asset and that asset itself. A level one input for fair value is the quoted price in an active market for an identical asset or liability. In other words, a level one is truly a mark-to-market measurement of fair value because it's using the price in the marketplace as a reflection of fair value. A level two input is one in which quoted prices for similar assets or liabilities are used, along with other observable information to determine the fair value of an asset or liability. That's frequently referred to as mark-to-matrix. A level three input is where unobservable inputs are used to measure fair value, and these are frequently referred to as mark-to-model fair value measurements, because inputs that are not directly related to the asset are used to determine the value by estimation. So if you think about the fair value hierarchy, it moves from its top level, which is a market-focused input, down to an estimated fair value using a variety of inputs and estimation techniques. FAS 157 emphasizes and prioritizes the use of observable inputs, that is, levels 1 and 2, but FAS 157 also emphasized that this fair value measurement is based on a hypothetical transaction that occurs in an orderly market. That is, it's not a distressed or a fire sale. Well, despite those definitions that were contained in FAS 157 as it was issued, in the midst of the credit crisis, there were substantial criticisms in the marketplace that led FASB to issue some clarifying guidance related to fair value measurements. And this clarifying guidance came in the form of what is called a FASB staff position. And this is an interpretation that is consistent with the standard itself that has been approved by the Financial Accounting Standards Board. And the particular one I'm going to talk about here is FSP FAS 157-4. And it deals with the market activity and the transaction normalcy when trying to determine whether or not to use
market prices to determine fair value. FSP, this particular FSP, contains a two-step test. And the first part of the two-step test is to question whether the market activity for a particular asset is normal. And it lists several different characteristics. Among them are whether there's been only a few recent transactions, whether the current price quotes are current or not, abnormally wide bid-ask spreads. So there are some characteristics listed to be able to answer the question whether the market activity is normal for a particular asset. If the market activity is not normal, then you need to go to the second test, which is to determine whether the transactions that are occurring in the marketplace are orderly or not. And the way that is assessed is to look at certain characteristics, like whether there was sufficient time before the measurement date to allow for usual and customary marketing activities, whether the seller is near bankruptcy, whether this transaction is an outlier compared to recent transactions. So you're provided with a variety of characteristics to determine whether the transactions that are occurring in the marketplace are orderly. If, based on those two tests, you determine that the market is not active and the transactions are not orderly, then an entity is required to use an estimation technique that uses something other than one that uses the quoted price without significant adjustments. In other words, you have to, the FSP provides guidance about using estimation techniques when mark-to-market accounting doesn't give you fair value. So fortunately, the expanded disclosure requirements in FAS 157 provide a lot of additional information about how firms are determining fair value, and and I think that provides an enormous amount of information to financial statement users to make an assessment about how whether or not they agree with the fair values determined by those estimations. And with that, I will stop.
Thank you very much. Well, you guys have all presented some very thought-provoking presentations. What I'd like to do now is just to have a bit of Q&A about some of the issues you've raised. And first, I'll just ask a general question to all of you. All of you guys have spoken about problems or products or issues that in one way or other have been the focus of new or proposed legislation. So first, I'd just like to get all of your kind of thoughts on some of that new legislation as it relates to the issues that you've raised. So Jan, I'll start with you.
Well, you know, I think that when you're looking at the SEC in particular, there are there are a number of issues that needed to be addressed and that are being addressed, but one item that I think we have to keep in mind is that when you look at the number of regulated entities per, you know, inspecting staff or you know, per staff member within various regulatory agencies, the SEC does not compare favorably to its peers, such as, you know, for instance, the CFTC. The SEC, by that measure, is under a huge amount of capacity constraint. And I think that that's something that we might have to look at a little more carefully.
Okay. Robert, do you have any thoughts?
Yes. I want to say a little bit about some of the proposals for regulating OTC derivatives, but I don't want to miss a chance to talk about mark-to-market accounting since it is so interesting.
I'm glad you're coming around, Robert.
Yes. And in part, I want to respond to the notion that somehow mark-to-market accounting in some significant sense contributed to the crisis. I mean, it's always struck me that even if we'd had a historical cost accounting system, all of the key players in the economy would have still been looking through to what they thought the real market values were. Shareholders in a firm, if you carry the assets at historical costs, that's not going to mean anything to them. They're going to look through to see what do they think the real values are. When the firm goes out to borrow additional funds, the creditors are going to look through to the real, market value. Counterparties to derivatives contracts, they're going to mark their exposures to market, not to some historical cost notion. Repo counterparties are going to mark the securities that have been lent to market, not to some historical notion. So all of the forces that led to the deleveraging in the economy, all of the forces that I think in part played into the credit crisis and the downturn, would still have taken place without even in the absence of the mark-to-market accounting, because market participants in their own contractual relationships will simply look through that, in my view. So let me turn for a moment just quickly to the OTC derivatives side, where there's now the Obama administration has a proposal on the table to require clearing of all CDS contracts, and in fact it goes beyond that. It would require clearing of all OTC derivatives, interest rate and currency and other swaps, and also not just centralized clearing, but actually exchange trading, either on a regulated exchange or a regulated electronic execution facility. I think the proposal goes too far. There's a bit of a carve out for non-standardized contracts, although if any one contract type is cleared, all other contracts of that type would be deemed to be standard, so they would get swept in. I think the extension of the exchange trading requirement and the clearing to the interest rate swap, the FX swap, other swap markets is unwarranted by what we experienced. I don't remember those contracts being part of the crisis. The argument for the CDS on the CDS side, I think there was a movement to more collateralization, probably a movement to clearing of more standardized CDS. The less standardized CDS, the customized ones, I think could be really problematic in a clearinghouse context. So I see some real problems with that proposal, but I'm sure some of those will be worked out as it works its way through Congress.
Thank you. And I know, Marcia, you've talked a little bit about your thoughts in terms of the new regulation and your proposed system.
Right. So maybe I'll just reiterate a bit here, but I would like to see Congress and the SEC really moving forward in terms of Ponzi scheme prevention mm-hmm. and detection. We don't want to be in the situation where a Madoff could do it all over again. I think the single most important measure is the one that the SEC proposed in May of this year that would effectively require an independent custodian for investment advisors. And I like the fact that the administration bill would go far towards getting advisors registered, even if their clients were hedge funds rather than individuals. I'd like to see it broader in scope there. But what neither of these proposals have is a way for the SEC to really validate the data that comes to it. And so I would strongly advocate the adoption of an IRS-type model where the SEC would be getting information on assets under management from multiple sources and could cost-effectively run those through a system without having to launch an investigation. It would just be automatically done, and people could gain a lot more assurance that their assets were what their advisor said they were.
Thank you. I think that the validation system is something that a lot of people would appreciate. Tom, let me ask you a slightly different question, because you talked a bit about FAS 157, and I know that subsequent interpretations have really validated the use of estimates instead of quoted prices where appropriate. So my question to you is, as companies use more and more estimates, how do you think auditors will react to that system?
Well, I think auditors would have, or probably do, have a preference for the use of quoted market prices because it provides them with a capability to validate the measurements that they say are in accordance with GAAP, so they fulfill some type of a verification objective. So I think the auditors are going to have to be convinced that quoted market prices are not reflective of fair value as it's defined in FAS 157, and to the extent that companies use more estimates, it's certainly going to require a heightened audit effort for the auditor to be satisfied that the amounts that are being included in the financial statements are reasonable and in accordance with GAAP. But the auditor also takes on a heightened audit risk for doing that, and so I think the bottom line of the whole the consideration of the auditor's role is that the use of estimates instead of quoted market prices are likely to increase the cost of an audit overall.
Yeah, thank you. I think that's something a lot of people would be interested. Of course, as Robert notes, mark to market has gotten a lot of exposure in the same way that credit default swaps have kind of gotten a lot of exposure, seeing as the bad guy. I actually have a question for Marcia here, though. Certainly, your proposed regime, which draws upon the IRS regime, ask for information from a variety of different people. And so one concern that it, of course, may raise is whether or not it compromises the privacy, particularly of investors and investment advisors. So I just wanted your thoughts with respect to that.
I think potentially it could, but the way I would like to see the system implemented would be that no account-level data would ever become public. So for individuals who reported to the SEC, they wouldn't have to fear that were to become public information. And I would also like that non-disclosure to extend to an advisor's asset positions. I think that would be a disclosure of proprietary trading strategy if that became known. So the IRS has a good record of keeping private information private. I think the SEC could do it as well.
Very interesting. One follow-up question to that, though, is, to the extent your system kind of relies on the voluntary enough of investors kind of providing information, would you need 100% of the investors to do so? Or
I'm so glad you asked that. The answer is no, and it's a good thing because you wouldn't get anything like that. I think investors would have two self-interested reasons to participate in this. One is that they would learn whether their own advisor acknowledged the assets that it was telling them that they had. Another is to help incentivize their advisor to report honestly. What I would also like to see, though, would be for Congress to pass a law whereby participating investors would have a higher priority in the event of a fraud-related bankruptcy and would have a greater claim to damages in the event of fraud-related litigation. These would be very good citizens who would be reporting to the SEC. They should get something in return.
Thank you. Very, very intriguing proposal, certainly. Let me ask you, Robert, a little bit about credit default swaps. You talked what you thought would be the defects in some of the new proposed legislation. Do you have some thoughts on, what you think we should do with credit default swaps going forward?
Yes, and I think it applies also to sort of OTC derivatives more generally. In the last few years, there's been a significant movement towards greater collateralization of these transactions. There should probably be less reliance on sort of AAA credit ratings of one of the counterparties and more reliance on collateral from the beginning or reliance on collateral with smaller thresholds. And I think we've seen in the last 5 years the percentage of OTC derivatives that have variation collateral is now quite high, something 70% or more. So those trends, I think, should certainly be encouraged. The market itself was moving towards a voluntary clearing system, certainly in the energy complex through the Intercontinental Exchange. They had developed a complex clearing for a lot of energy contracts. So I think there'd be a fair bit of support within the industry for clearing houses themselves, but the mandatory requirement for all clearing of standardized contracts and then even some non-standardized that might get swept in. I think that's quite problematic.
Thank you. And Con, let me ask you a question. You talked about kind of the SEC's power and authority, especially with respect to penalties, and I believe there are some kind of Treasury Department recommendations about the creation of some regulatory authorities whose jurisdiction could potentially overlap with the SEC, and I wondered if you could give us some thoughts with respect to that.
Yeah, so last month the Treasury Department put out a lengthy report called Financial Regulatory Reform, A New Foundation. and that recommended a number of reforms of the SEC as well as other agencies. Prior to that report, there had been some talk of potentially combining the CFTC and SEC, in fact. The Treasury report does not recommend that, but it does propose adding three new authorities that would indeed overlap with the SEC. There would be a Financial Services Oversight Council, which would be composed of the heads of 8 financial regulatory agencies, including the chairman of the SEC, and its job would be to identify emerging risks and to serve as a forum for disputes between regulators. The Federal Reserve would be given broader regulatory authority, including over all large interconnected financial firms, many of which, of course, would be regulated by the SEC as well. And a new consumer protection agency would be established, and its authority would include retail securities products that are currently regulated by the SEC. There's clearly talk of, you know, potential big changes ahead.
I wondered if anyone else had thoughts about kind of, you know, there's been a lot of proposals also on the table, just like this Treasury Department one, about kind of creation of new agencies. I don't know if people had thoughts about potential coordination issues with that, you know, whether or not it makes sense to try to create kind of additional agencies to do some of the regulation, for example, with credit default swaps, or to think in a different way about accounting. I don't know if anybody else had questions or thoughts on that one.
Just an observation, which is, in going back to 1988, after the crash of 87, the President's Working Group on Financial Markets was established, and it's been in operation since then. And that group has served as the coordinating function across all of these agencies over that period. Part of what's being proposed now is to take that responsibility and put it into this more centralized group. In some sense, in my view, they were already doing a lot of that. There's interesting questions about sort of why that coordination may not have been as successful as it could have been, why some of the agencies that had some authority to oversee certain entities such as AIG may not have done as good a job as we might have hoped they did. But yet I think some of what is coming up now is it's not that different than what we had, but it's institutionalizing in a different way.
Yeah, and possibly, hopefully, that will make a difference. Certainly,
yes,
we'll see in the future. Well, let me close out now. Thank you, Marcia, Robert, Tom, and Jan, for sharing your excerpts from your papers from NERA Economic Consulting's recent Finance, Law, and Securities Litigation Seminar. It's quite clear why your presentations were deemed the best at this year's conference. You guys had some really engaging and intriguing thoughts on a variety of extremely relevant topics. Today's broadcast can be accessed again on demand through the Virtual Museum and Archive, and an edited transcript will soon be available. The museum's next broadcast will be a new program, Bingham Presents, on Thursday, September 24th, beginning at 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The program will be broadcast live from the offices of Bingham McCutcheon, LLP, in New York City, and online at www.sechistorical.org. The online broadcast will be free and accessible worldwide without prior registration. The focus of the program will be the new world of financial regulation, looking at the proposed Financial Product Safety Commission. My colleague, Professor Teresa Gabaldon of the George Washington University Law School, will moderate the program. Presenters will include Jesse Eisinger of Condé Nast and Professor Joseph Stiglitz of Columbia University. Please plan to join us on www.sechistorical.org on September 24th. Thank you again for being with us today.